This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Baruch Goldstein, the doctor who massacred Palestinians at a Hebron mosque last week, was part of a larger movement of extremists. My guest, Ehud Sprinzak, is one of Israel's leading experts on extremism and violence. He's a professor of political science at Hebrew University and author of the book The Ascendance of Israel's Radical Right. The Middle East peace talks are on hold as a result of the massacre. The PLO has said it won't return to the table unless Israel disarms the Jewish settlers in the occupied territories. Goldstein was a settler in the West Bank. Earlier today, we called Sprinzak in Jerusalem and asked him to explain Israel's policy on arms for Jewish settlers in the territories.
Ever since 1967 and the occupation, it has been a standing order that if you go to the occupied territories, because of the danger of terrorism, you have to carry guns. It is not just privilege, it's an obligation and a duty. And the reason that settlers carry guns is not because they're going to attack so much as to defend themselves. And the vast majority of the settlers are not that aggressive. They've not been involved in anything closer to what Goldstein did. So I guess there is a sentiment that we shouldn't lump Goldstein with the entire settler community here.
So is it the army that gives the guns to settlers?
Yeah, it is the army. I mean, in addition, individuals can buy handguns on their own. But settlers who have served in the army, and as you know, every young man in Israel since the age of 18 is required to serve in the army. For those people, they can get guns from the army.
And just to clarify, when a settler moves to the territories, are they given a gun by the government? Or are they just allowed to keep the gun that they have from their military service?
No. They are given a gun by the military. Israeli soldiers do not keep their arms at home. So if you live in an area, and especially if it is a very sensitive area, much of the settlements and the majority of the settlers live very close to the old border and not in the vicinity of Arab neighborhoods and Arab villages, so they don't need those guns. But those who live far away in sensitive areas are required to hold the guns.
So the guns are issued for self-protection?
Basically, yes.
What are the settlers' fears about being disarmed?
Well, exactly what I told you. I mean, there is great Arab animosity, Palestinian animosity, and there is a fear that they will be attacked. In terms of terrorism, the volume of Palestinian terrorism has been quite high. So the fear is to be hurt.
Would it be possible for you to say what percentage of settlers in the territories are actually militant and extremists or vigilantes?
Well, we have to make several distinctions. The most extreme and violent, and as a matter of fact, even terroristic, are very few, and they are the members of the organization that has been involved in the recent massacre or Goldstein was a member of. These are the followers of the late Rabbi Kahane. Their numbers is very small, and the hardcore of them is not more than a few dozen. Then they have some supporters, like a few hundreds. But the rest of the settler community may be opposed to the peace process, may be ready to demonstrate, even to challenge the government. But they're not murderous in that respect, and would not do anything close to what Goldstein did.
Did you keep tabs on Goldstein in your studies of the radical right? Did you know about him?
Well, I knew about him, but I didn't know him. He was not a typical activist, a violent activist. You know that he was the doctor of the community. And I didn't expect anybody like it, certainly not Goldstein, to be involved in this massacre. I think he must have gone, in addition to the ideology and the group feeling and everything else, he must have gone through a personal crisis. Something broke down in him. Which led him to do this, but he was not the typical mass killer that one expects, if at all.
What do you mean he wasn't typical? You mean because he was a doctor, or?
Yeah, he was saving people. most of the time his job was to save people. And I have seen on television an Arab who couldn't believe that he was involved in the murder because he saved his life a few months earlier.
That's interesting, because I had heard that Dr. Goldstein wouldn't treat Arabs.
Well, there were cases in which he refused. I mean, there was some kind of contradiction in this person. And to this very day, I have not heard a full account or a full analysis of his personality. So at certain points, he said he would not treat Arabs. But at the same time, we have evidence to the contrary. So in any way, people who knew him thought he was a very sensitive guy until it came to the ideology and to the matter of, like, the collective danger of the Arabs.
How did Kiryat Arba, the community that Goldstein lived in, become a center for militant activities, settler militant activities?
Well, I will tell you. From the beginning, when Jews came to Hebron, when the settlers came back to Hebron in 1968, there was kind of blood in the air because of the bitter memories of the massacre of the Jewish community of Hebron in 1929. So the people that returned did not just return in order to rehabilitate a Jewish ancient place. They also returned to make a point. And there was always a sense of revenge. So people who were less radical would not go to such a place. And there are lots of settlements in the occupied territories. I mean, if you want to become a settler, you don't have to go to the most sensitive and extreme place. But that particular place attracted the more radical elements. Then in the mid-70s, Rabbi Meir Kahana has called upon his followers to go and settle in Kiryat Arba. And quite a few of them did, including some American followers of him. And so there was a culture created in the area which spelled out radicalism, extremism, very strong anti-Arab sense, and a feeling, I would say, even of a need for revenge. So as I said, the more people came to the territories, the more radical elements who wanted to make a point that this is all ours, that this is fully Jewish, and we cannot forgive and we cannot forget, went to that place. So it's kind of a slow process through which a culture of extremism was created.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ehud Sprinzak, and he's the author of the book The Ascendance of Israel's Radical Right. He's a professor of political science at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and he's speaking to us from his home. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ehud Sprinzak, who is an expert on the rise of Israel's radical right. Meir Kahani founded an extremist group in the United States before he settled in Israel in 1971. In your book, The Ascendance of Israel's Radical Right, you write that Kahani's most notorious ideological contribution was the glorification of Jewish violence. What do you mean by that?
I mean exactly what I say. I mean, I studied Rabbi Kahane for many years, including many talks with him. And I came to the conclusion that the strongest drive in his life was a sense of strong identification with the Jewish humiliation and persecution throughout 2,000 years of diaspora. Kahane could not forget and could not forgive for a single moment in his life of what was done to Jews, from pogroms to persecutions to finally gassing them in the Holocaust. And he had this urge for revenge. Now, around this urge, he produced a theology of violence, which spelled out that if in the past the Gentiles, when they wanted to desecrate the name of God, attacked his people, desecrated them, killed them, then now Jews responding, meaning it is sanctification of the name of God. So this element of revenge, around this element of revenge, a whole theology and also a system of education was built, according to which it is glorious, even holy, for a Jew to attack a Gentile who is in one way or another hostile to him. And what Kahane did, in addition to writing about this many times, is to try and produce in his Jewish Defense League, the American organization, even before he came to Israel, he tried to produce a new type of Jew, a young Jew who would not feel guilty about using violence. So in this respect, we are talking about a unique, not just a theology of violence, but even a system of socialization. Followers of Rabbi Kahane, and I'm afraid that one of them was Goldstein, were told when you confront these guys, especially if they have something against you, don't feel guilty. And this explains, in my judgment, the applauding of the act of the massacre of Friday after the fact. Usually you do not expect people to admit that they're pleased by such horrible act.
Do you have a sense of what it was socially or politically that enabled Kahane's extremist thoughts to catch on in a small segment of the Israeli population?
Well, I have to tell you, it didn't catch on. Kahane became popular. You know, he was elected to Israeli parliament in 1984. He became popular not because of this theology, which only his immediate followers were aware of, so much as for his anti-Arab propaganda and the call for expulsion of all Arabs from Palestine, from the land of Israel. Now, this was something which, it's the dream of every Israeli, you know, just to have a clean country. And I guess simple-minded, unhappy people about other things kind of liked that idea. This made Kahane popular. Also, he was very good in taking an anti-establishment style, appealing to the downtrodden, the lower middle class, the losers in Israeli society. And this made him popular, not so much the theology of violence, which was shared by a few people, but unfortunately, even a few is too many.
Could you give us a brief overview of other strains of religious and secular extremism now in the territories?
Well, there is another movement, which is basically the most influential movement, which is called Gush Emunim, the Block of the Faithful. I write a great deal about them in my book. They have a different approach to the methods and the way of dealing with Arabs. I mean, they share the Kahane belief, Jewish fundamentalist belief, that all the land is ours, that it will be a rebellion against God to give back, and basically the people of Israel cannot be redeemed unless the entire territory is in Jewish hands. But when it comes to the methods, they are a lot more traditional. That is to say, when they speak about violence, they only speak in terms of self-defense. They're restrained. They're not for the expulsion of all Arabs. It's not that they're moderate. They're very much against the peace process, and they're very angry at the government, and they refuse to recognize the PLO or anything like it. But their modus operandi, the way they do things, the way they behave, is totally different.
How much power do you think the radical right in Israel has now to derail the peace process?
Well, let me put it this way. When I spoke to you in 1991, they had a lot more power because, in addition to the numbers, they had a very supportive government. And for the Likud government in 1991, and for several years, they were really the darlings of the camp. They were the Zionists of our days. Now, this is no longer the case. Right now, the Israeli people have turned its back, and it has now supported a very liberal and moderate government. Now, under those conditions, the same number of people who once could have exerted a lot more influence are in a much tougher situation. As a matter of fact, they're more isolated than ever before, and they're very unhappy. This is why I think that politically they are in no position to subvert the peace process. The only thing that could help them, and this is why this massacre, in addition to the human side, horrible human side, is dangerous politically, the only thing that could help them is violence. Because if tensions go up, if Jewish extremists and Arab extremists kill each other, they could create a sense of insecurity in the community, which would consequently have reduced the support of the Israeli people of the government.
What do you think of the PLO proposal to disarm all the settlers in the territories?
Well, I can understand the feelings of the PLO, but this is unrealistic, politically speaking. In addition to what I've already said about the fact that the settlers need those arms for self-defense, this government would not get the support of the Israeli people for such an act. So it's impossible. It's just unrealistic. It's an idea. And I would suggest to the PLO to let the Israeli government do what they can and move fast into the peace process. Because if the peace process moves fast, then, of course, many of these things would not be required because there would be soon a Palestinian autonomy.
Ehud Sprinzak is a professor of political science at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's the author of The Ascendance of Israel's Radical Right. This is Fresh Air.